fog, although I'm not sure why. Maybe because he's the biggest, or maybe because he had to exert himself the most. And then, of course, there's Mags. I still don't understand what happened there, why he essentially abandoned her to carry Peeta, why she not only didn't question it, but ran straight to her death without a moment's hesitation. Was it because she was so old that her days were numbered anyway? Did they think that Finnick would stand a better chance of winning if he had Peeta and me as allies? The haggard look on Finnick's face tells me that now is not the moment to ask. Instead, I try to put myself back together. I rescue my Mockingjay pin from my ruined jumpsuit and pin it to the strap of my undershirt. The flotation belt must be acid-resistant, since it looks as good as new. I can swim, so the flotation belt's not really necessary, but Brutus blocked my arrow with his, so I buckle it back on, thinking it might offer some protection. I undo my hair and comb it with my fingers, thinning it out considerably since the fog droplets damaged it. Then I braid back what's left of it. Peeta has found a good tree about 10 yards from the narrow strip of beach. We can hardly see him, but the sound of his knife against the wooden trunk is crystal clear. I wonder what happened to the awl. Mags must have either dropped it or taken it into the fog with her. Anyway, it's gone. I have moved out a bit farther into the shallows, floating alternately on my belly and back. If the seawater healed Peeta and me, it seems to be transforming Finnick altogether. He begins to move slowly, just testing his limbs, and gradually begins to swim. But it's not like me swimming, the rhythmic strokes, the even pace. It's like watching some strange sea animal coming back to life. He dives and surfaces, spraying water out of his mouth, rolls over and over in some bizarre corkscrew motion that makes me dizzy even to watch. And then, when he's been underwater so long, I feel certain he's drowned. His head pops up right next to me, and I start. "Don't do that," I say.
"What? Come up or stay under?" he says.
"Either. Neither. Whatever. Just soak in the water and behave," I say. "Or if you feel this good, let's go help Peeta." In just the short time it takes to cross to the edge of the jungle, I become aware of the change. Put it down to years of hunting, or maybe my reconstructed ear does work a little better than anyone intended, but I sense the mass of warm bodies poised above us. They don't need to chatter or scream. The mere breathing of so many is enough. I touch Finnick's arm, and he follows my gaze upward. I don't know how they arrived so silently. Perhaps they didn't. We've all been absorbed in restoring our bodies. During that time, they've assembled. Not 5 or 10, but scores of monkeys weighed down the limbs of the jungle trees. The pair we spotted when we first escaped the fog felt like a welcoming committee. This crew feels ominous. I arm my bow with 2 arrows, and Finnick adjusts the trident in his hand.
"Peeta!"
I say as calmly as possible.
"I need your help with something."
"Okay, just a minute. I think I've almost got it," he says, still occupied with the tree.
"Yes, there. Have you got the spile?"
"I do, but we found something you better take a look at," I continue in a measured voice. "Only move toward us quietly, so you don't startle it." For some reason, I don't want him to notice the monkeys or even glance their way. There are creatures that interpret mere eye contact as aggression. Peeta turns to us, panting from his work on the tree. The tone of my request is so odd that it's alerted him to some irregularity.
"Okay," he says casually.
He begins to move through the jungle, and although I know he's trying hard to be quiet, this has never been his strong suit, even when he had 2 sound legs. But it's all right. He's moving. The monkeys are holding their positions. He's just 5 yards from the beach when he senses them.
His eyes only dart up for a second, but it's as if he's triggered a bomb. The monkeys explode into a shrieking mass of orange fur and converge on him. I've never seen any animal move so fast. They slide down the vines as if the things were greased, leap impossible distances from tree to tree, fangs bared, hackles raised, claws shooting out like switchblades. I may be unfamiliar with monkeys, but animals in nature don't act like this. Mutts! I spit out as Finnick and I crash into the greenery. I know every arrow must count, and they do. In the eerie light, I bring down monkey after monkey, targeting eyes and hearts and throats, so that each hit means a death. But still, it wouldn't be enough without Finnick spearing the beasts like fish and flinging them aside, Peeta slashing away with his knife. I feel claws on my legs, down my back, before someone takes on the attacker. The air grows heavy with trampled plants, the scent of blood, and the musty stink of the monkeys. Peeta and Finnick and I have positioned ourselves in a triangle, a few yards apart, our backs to one another. My heart sinks as my fingers draw back my last arrow. Then I remember Peeta has a sheath too, and he's not shooting, he's hacking away with that knife. My own knife is out now, but the monkeys are quicker, can spring in and out so fast you can barely react. "Peeta!" I shout. "Your arrows!" Peeta turns to see my predicament and is sliding off his sheath when it happens. A monkey lunges out of a tree for his chest. I have no arrows, no way to shoot. I can hear the thud of Finnick's trident, finding another mark, and know his weapon is occupied. Peeta's knife arm is disabled as he tries to remove the sheath. I throw my knife at the oncoming mutt, but the creature somersaults, evading the blade, and stays on its trajectory. Weaponless, defenseless, I do the only thing I can think of. I run for Peeta, to knock him to the ground, to protect his body with mine, even though I know I won't make it in time. She does, though, materializing, it seems, from thin air. One moment nowhere, the next reeling in front of Peeta. Already bloody, mouth open in a high-pitched scream, pupils enlarged so her eyes seem like black holes. The insane morphling from District 6 throws up her skeletal arm as if to embrace the monkey, and it sinks its fangs into her chest. Chapter 22. Peeta drops the sheath and buries his knife into the monkey's back, stabbing it again and again until it releases its jaw. He kicks the mutt away, bracing for more. I have his arrows now, a loaded bow, and Finnick at my back, breathing hard but not actively engaged. "Come on, then! Come on!" shouts Peeta, panting with rage. But something has happened to the monkeys. They are withdrawing, backing up trees, fading into the jungle, as if some unheard voice calls them away. A game-maker's voice, telling them this is enough. "Get her," I say to Peeta. "We'll cover you." Peeta gently lifts up the morphling and carries her the last few yards to the beach while Finnick and I keep our weapons at the ready. But except for the orange carcasses on the ground, the monkeys are gone. Peeta lays the morphling on the sand. I cut away the material over her chest, revealing the four deep puncture wounds. Blood slowly trickles from them, making them look far less deadly than they are. The real damage is inside. By the position of the openings, I feel certain the beast ruptured something vital, a lung, maybe even her heart. She lies on the sand, gasping like a fish out of water, sagging skin, sickly green, her ribs as prominent as a child's, dead of starvation. Surely she could afford food, but turned to the morphling, just as Haymitch turned to drink, I guess. Everything about her speaks of waste, her body, her life, the vacant look in her eyes. I hold one of her twitching hands, unclear whether it moves from the poison that affected our nerves, the shock of the attack,
or withdrawal from the drug that was her sustenance. There is nothing we can do, nothing but stay with her while she dies.
I'll watch the trees, Finnick says before walking away.
I'd like to walk away too, but she grips my hand so tightly I would have to pry off her fingers, and I don't have the strength for that kind of cruelty. I think of Rue, how maybe I could sing a song or something, but I don't even know the Morphling's name, let alone if she likes songs. I just know she's dying. Peter crouches down on the other side of her and strokes her hair. When he begins to speak in a soft voice, it seems almost nonsensical, but the words aren't for me. With my paint box at home, I can make every color imaginable, pink, as pale as baby's skin, or as deep as rhubarb, green like spring grass, blue that shimmers like ice on water. The Morphling stares into Peeta's eyes, hanging on to his words. One time, I spent 3 days mixing paint until I found the right shade for sunlight on white fur. You see, I kept thinking it was yellow, but it was much more than that. Layers of all sorts of color, one by one, says Peeta. The Morphling's breathing is slowing into shallow catch breaths. Her free hand dabbles in the blood on her chest, making the tiny swirling motions she so loved to paint with. I haven't figured out a rainbow yet. They come so quickly and leave so soon. I never have enough time to capture them. Just a bit of blue here or purple there, and then they fade away again, back into the air, says Peeta. The Morphling seems mesmerized by Peeta's words, entranced. She lifts up a trembling hand and paints what I think might be a flower on Peeta's cheek.
Thank you, he whispers. That looks beautiful.
For a moment, the Morphling's face lights up in a grin, and she makes a small squeaking sound. Then her blood-dappled hand falls back onto her chest. She gives one last huff of air, and the cannon fires. The grip on my hand releases. Peeta carries her out into the water. He returns and sits beside me. The Morphling floats out toward the cornucopia for a while, then the hovercraft appears, and a four-pronged claw drops, encases her, carries her into the night sky, and she's gone. Finnick rejoins us, his fist full of my arrows still wet with monkey blood. He drops them beside me on the sand.
Thought you might want these.
Thanks, I say. I wade into the water and wash off the gore from my weapons, my wounds. By the time I return to the jungle to gather some moss to dry them, all the monkeys' bodies have vanished.
Where did they go? I ask.
We don't know exactly. The vines shifted and they were gone, says Finnick.
We stare at the jungle, numb and exhausted. In the quiet, I noticed that the spots where the fog droplets touched my skin have scabbed over. They've stopped hurting and begun to itch, intensely. I try to think of this as a good sign, that they are healing. I glance over at Peeta, at Finnick, and see they're both scratching at their damaged faces. Yes, even Finnick's beauty has been marred by this night.
Don't scratch, I say,
wanting badly to scratch myself, but I know it's the advice my mother would give. You'll only bring infection. Think it's safe to try for the water again? We make our way back to the tree Peeta was tapping. Finnick and I stand with our weapons poised while he works the spile in. But no threat appears. Peeta's found a good vein, and the water begins to gush from the spile. We slake our thirst, let the warm water pour over our itching bodies. We fill a handful of shells with drinking water and go back to the beach. It's still night,
though dawn can't be too many hours away, unless the game makers want it to be. Why don't you two get some rest, I say. I'll watch for a while.
No, Katniss, I'd rather, says Finnick.
I look in his eyes, at his face, and realize he's barely holding back tears. Mags, the least I can do is give him the privacy to mourn her. All right, Finnick. Thanks, I say. I lie down on the sand with Peeta, who drifts off at once. I stare into the night, thinking of what a difference a day makes. How yesterday morning, Finnick was on my kill list, and now I'm willing to sleep with him as my guard. He saved Peeta and let Mags die, and I don't know why. Only that I can never settle the balance owed between us. All I can do at the moment is go to sleep and let him grieve in peace. And so I do. It's mid-morning when I open my eyes again. Peeta's still out beside me. Above us, a mat of grass suspended on branches shields our faces from the sunlight. I sit up and see that Finnick's hands have not been idle. Two woven bowls are filled with fresh water. A third holds a mess of shellfish. Finnick sits on the sand, cracking them open with a stone.
They're better fresh, he says,
ripping a chunk of flesh from a shell and popping it into his mouth. His eyes are still puffy, but I pretend not to notice. My stomach begins to growl at the smell of food, and I reach for one. The sight of my fingernails, caked with blood, stops me. I've been scratching my skin raw in my sleep.
You know, if you scratch, you'll bring on infection, says Finnick.
That's what I've heard, I say. I go into the salt water and wash off the blood, trying to decide which I hate more, pain or itching. Fed up, I stomp back onto the beach, turn my face upward, and snap.
Hey! Hamish! If you're not too drunk, we could use a little something for our skin.
It's almost funny how quickly the parachute appears above me. I reach up, and the tube lands squarely in my open hand. About time, I say, but I can't keep the scowl on my face. Hamish, what I wouldn't give for 5 minutes of conversation with him. I plunk down on the sand next to Finnick and screw the lid off the tube. Inside is a thick, dark ointment with a pungent smell, a combination of tar and pine needles. I wrinkle my nose as I squeeze a glob of the medicine onto my palm and begin to massage it into my leg. A sound of pleasure slips out of my mouth as the stuff eradicates my itching. It also stains my scabby skin a ghastly gray-green. As I start on the second leg, I toss the tube to Finnick, who eyes me doubtfully.
It's like you're decomposing, says Finnick.
But I guess the itching wins out, because after a minute, Finnick begins to treat his own skin, too. Really, the combination of the scabs and the ointment looks hideous. I can't help enjoying his distress.
Poor Finnick, is this the first time in your life you haven't looked pretty? I say.
It must be. The sensation's completely new. How have you managed it all these years? He asks.
Just avoid mirrors. You'll forget about it, I say.
Not if I keep looking at you, he says.
We slather ourselves down, even taking turns rubbing the ointment into each other's backs where the undershirts don't protect our skin.
I'm going to wake Peeta, I say.
No, wait, says Finnick. Let's do it together. Put our faces right in front of his.
Well, there's so little opportunity for fun left in my life, I agree. We position ourselves on either side of Peeta, lean over until our faces are inches from his nose, and give him a shake.
Peeta, Peeta, wake up,
I say in a soft, sing-song voice. His eyelids flutter open, and then he jumps like we've stabbed him.
Ah!
Finnick and I fall back in the sand, laughing our heads off. Every time we try to stop, we look at Peeta's attempt to maintain a disdainful expression, and it sets us off again. By the time we pull ourselves together, I'm thinking that maybe Finnick O'Dare is all right, at least not as vain or self-important as I'd thought. Not so bad at all, really. And just as I've come to this conclusion, a parachute lands next to us with a fresh loaf of bread. Remembering from last year how Haymitch's gifts are often timed to send a message, I make a note to myself. Be friends with Finnick, you'll get food. Finnick turns the bread over in his hands, examining the crust. A bit too possessively. It's not necessary. It's got that green tint from seaweed that the bread from District 4 always has. We all know it's his. Maybe he's just realized how precious it is, and that he may never see another loaf again. Maybe some memory of Mags is associated with the crust, but all he says is, "This will go well with the shellfish." While I help Peter coat his skin with the ointment, Finnick deftly cleans the meat from the shellfish. We gather round and eat the delicious sweet flesh with the salty bread from District 4. We all look monstrous. The ointment seems to be causing some of the scabs to peel, but I'm glad for the medicine, not just because it gives relief from the itching, but also because it acts as protection from that blazing white sun in the pink sky. By its position, I estimate it must be going on 10 o'clock, and we've been in the arena for about a day. 11 of us are dead, 13 alive. Somewhere in the jungle, 10 are concealed. 3 or 4 are the careers. I don't really feel like trying to remember who the others are. For me, the jungle has quickly evolved from a place of protection to a sinister trap. I know at some point we'll be forced to re-enter its depths, either to hunt or be hunted, but right now I'm planning to stick to our little beach. And I don't hear Peter or Finnick suggesting we do otherwise. For a while the jungle seems almost static, humming, shimmering, but not flaunting its dangers. Then, in the distance, comes screaming. Across from us, a wedge of the jungle begins to vibrate. An enormous wave crests high on the hill, topping the trees and roaring down the slope. It hits the existing seawater with such force that even though we're as far as we can get from it, the surf bubbles up around our knees, setting our few possessions afloat. Among the three of us, we manage to collect everything before it's carried off, except for our chemical-riddled jumpsuits, which are so eaten away no one cares if we lose them. A cannon fires. We see the hovercraft appear over the area where the wave began and pluck a body from the trees. 12, I think. The circle of water slowly calms down, having absorbed the giant wave. We rearrange our things back on the wet sand and are about to settle down when I see them. 3 figures, about 2 spokes away, stumbling onto the beach. "There," I say quietly, nodding in the newcomer's direction. Peter and Finnick follow my gaze. As if by previous agreement, we all fade back into the shadows of the jungle. The trio's in bad shape. You can see that right off. One is being practically dragged out by a second, and the third wanders in loopy circles, as if deranged. They're a solid brick-red color, as if they've been dipped in paint and left out to dry. "Who is that?" asks Peter. "Or what? Mutations?" I draw back an arrow, readying for an attack. But all that happens is that the one who was being dragged collapses on the beach. The dragger stamps the ground in frustration and, in an apparent fit of temper, turns and shoves the circling deranged one over. Finnick's face lights up. "Joanna!" he calls and runs for the red things. "Finnick!" I hear Joanna's voice reply. I exchange a look with Peter. "What now?" I ask. "We can't really leave Finnick," he says. "Guess not. Come on, then," I say grouchily, because even if I'd had a list of allies, Joanna Mason would definitely not have been on it. The two of us tromp down the beach to where Finnick and Joanna are just meeting up. As we move in closer, I see her companions, and confusion sets in.
that's Beatty on the ground on his back, and Wyrus, who's regained her feet to continue making loops. She's got Wyrus and Beatty.
Nuts and volts? Says Peter, equally puzzled. I've got to hear how this happened.
When we reach them, Joanna's gesturing toward the jungle and talking very fast to Finnick.
We thought it was rain, you know, because of the lightning. And we were all so thirsty. But when it started coming down, it turned out to be blood, thick, hot blood. You couldn't see, you couldn't speak without getting a mouthful. We just staggered around, trying to get out of it. That's when Blight hit the force field.
I'm sorry, Joanna, says Finnick. It takes a moment to place Blight. I think he was Joanna's male counterpart from District 7, but I hardly remember seeing him.
Come to think of it, I don't even think he showed up for training.
Yeah, well, he wasn't much, but he was from home, she says. And he left me alone with these two.
She nudges Beatty, who's barely conscious, with her shoe.
He got a knife in the back at the cornucopia, and her.
We all look over at Wyrus, who's circling around, coated in dried blood, and murmuring,
Tick-tock, tick-tock. Yeah, we know, tick-tock, Nuts is in shock, says Joanna.
This seems to draw Wyrus in her direction, and she careens into Joanna, who harshly shoves her to the beach.
Just stay down, will you?
Lay off her, I snap. Joanna narrows her brown eyes at me in hatred.
Lay off her? She hisses.
She steps forward before I can react, and slaps me so hard I see stars.
Who do you think got them out of that bleeding jungle for you, you?
Finnick tosses her writhing body over his shoulder and carries her out into the water and repeatedly dunks her while she screams a lot of really insulting things at me. But I don't shoot, because she's with Finnick and because of what she said about getting them out for me.
What did she mean? She got them for me? I ask Peter.
I don't know. You did want them originally, he reminds me.
Yeah, I did, originally. But that answers nothing. I look down at Beatty's inert body. But I won't have them long unless we do something. Peter lifts Beatty up in his arms, and I take Wyrus by the hand, and we go back to our little beach camp. I sit Wyrus in the shallows so she can get washed up a bit, but she just clutches her hands together and occasionally mumbles, Tick-tock. I unhook Beatty's belt and find a heavy metal cylinder attached to the side with a rope of vines. I can't tell what it is, but if he thought it was worth saving, I'm not going to be the one who loses it. I toss it up on the sand. Beatty's clothes are glued to him with blood, so Peter holds him in the water while I loosen them. It takes some time to get off the jumpsuit. And then we find his undergarments are saturated with blood as well. There's no choice but to strip him naked to get him clean. But I have to say, this doesn't make much of an impression on me anymore. Our kitchen table's been full of so many naked men this year. You get kind of used to it after a while. We put down Finnick's mat and lay Beatty on his stomach so we can examine his back. There's a gash about 6 inches long running from his shoulder blade to below his ribs. Fortunately, it's not too deep. He's lost a lot of blood, though, you can tell by the pallor of his skin, and it's still oozing out of the wound. I sit back on my heels, trying to think. What do I have to work with? Seawater. I feel like my mother when her first line of defense for treating everything was snow. I look over at the jungle. I bet there's a whole pharmacy in there if I knew how to use it. But these aren't my plants. Then I think about the moss Mags gave me to blow my nose. Be right back, I tell Peter. Fortunately, the stuff seems to be pretty common in the jungle. I rip an armful from the nearby trees and carry it back to the beach. I make a thick pad out of the moss, place it on Beatty's cut, and secure it by tying vines around his body. We get some water into him
and then pull him into the shade at the edge of the jungle.
I think that's all we can do, I say.
It's good. You're good with this healing stuff, he says. It's in your blood.
No, I say, shaking my head. I got my father's blood.
The kind that quickens during a hunt, not an epidemic.
I'm going to see about Wyrus. I take a handful of the moss to use as a rag and join Wyrus in the shallows. She doesn't resist as I work off her clothing, scrub the blood from her skin, but her eyes are dilated with fear, and when I speak, she doesn't respond except to say with ever-increasing urgency, "Tick-tock!" She does seem to be trying to tell me something, but with no Beatty to explain her thoughts, I'm at a loss.
Yes, tick-tock, tick-tock, I say. This seems to calm her down a little. I wash out her jumpsuit until there's hardly a trace of blood and help her back into it. It's not damaged like ours were. Her belt's fine, so I fasten that on, too. Then I pin her undergarments along with Beatty's under some rocks and let them soak. By the time I've rinsed out Beatty's jumpsuit, a shiny, clean Joanna and peeling Finnick have joined us. For a while, Joanna gulps water and stuffs herself with shellfish while I try to coax something into Wyrus. Finnick tells about the fog and the monkeys in a detached, almost clinical voice, avoiding the most important detail of the story. Everybody offers to guard while the others rest, but in the end, it's Joanna and I who stay up, me because I'm really rested, she because she simply refuses to lie down. The two of us sit in silence on the beach until the others have gone to sleep. Joanna glances over at Finnick, to be sure, then turns to me.
How'd you lose, Mags?
In the fog. Finnick had Peeta, I had Mags for a while, then I couldn't lift her. Finnick said he couldn't take them both. She kissed him and walked right into the poison, I say.
She was Finnick's mentor, you know, Joanna says accusingly.
No, I didn't, I say.
She was half his family, she says a few moments later, but there's less venom behind it.
We watch the water lap up over the undergarments.
So, what were you doing with nuts and bolts, I ask.
I told you, I got them for you. Hamish said if we were to be allies, I had to bring them to you, says Joanna.
That's what you told him, right?
No, I think, but I nod my head in assent.
Thanks, I appreciate it. I hope so.
She gives me a look filled with loathing, like I'm the biggest drag possible on her life. I wonder if this is what it's like to have an older sister who really hates you.
Tick-tock,
I hear behind me. I turn and see Wyrus has crawled over. Her eyes are focused on the jungle.
Oh, goody, she's back. Okay, I'm going to sleep. You and Nuts can guard together, Joanna says.
She goes over and flings herself down beside Finnick.
Tick-tock,
whispers Wyrus. I guide her in front of me and get her to lie down, stroking her arm to soothe her. She drifts off, stirring restlessly, occasionally sighing out her phrase.
Tick-tock.
Tick-tock, I agree softly. It's time for bed. Tick-tock. Go to sleep. The sun rises in the sky until it's directly over us. It must be noon, I think absently. Not that it matters. Across the water, off to the right, I see the enormous flash as the lightning bolt hits the tree and the electrical storm begins again. Right in the same area it did last night. Someone must have moved into its range, triggered the attack. I sit for a while watching the lightning, keeping Wyrus calm, lulled into a sort of peacefulness by the lapping of the water. I think of last night, how the lightning began just after the bell tolled. 12 bongs.
Tick-tock,
Wyrus says, surfacing to consciousness for a moment and then going back under. 12 bongs last night. Like it was midnight, then lightning, the sun overhead now, like it's noon, and lightning. Slowly I rise up and survey the arena. The lightning there. In the next pie wedge over came the blood rain, where Joanna Wiris and Beatty were caught. We would have been in the third section, right next to that, when the fog appeared, and as soon as it was sucked away, the monkeys began to gather in the fourth. Tick-tock! My head snaps to the other side. A couple of hours ago, at around 10, that wave came out of the second section to the left of where the lightning strikes now. At noon, at midnight, at noon. Tick-tock, Wiris says in her sleep. As the lightning ceases and the blood rain begins just to the right of it, her words suddenly make sense. Oh, I say under my breath. Tick-tock. My eyes sweep around the full circle of the arena, and I know she's right. Tick-tock. This is a clock.
Chapter 23. A clock. I can almost see the hands ticking around the 12-sectioned face of the arena. Each hour begins a new horror, a new game-maker weapon, and ends the previous. Lightning, blood rain, fog, monkeys, those are the first 4 hours on the clock. And at 10, the wave. I don't know what happens in the other 7, but I know Wiris is right. At present, the blood rain's falling, and we're on the beach below the monkey segment, far too close to the fog for my liking. Do the various attacks stay within the confines of the jungle? Not necessarily. The wave didn't. If that fog leaches out of the jungle, or the monkeys return... Get up, I order, shaking Peeta and Finnick and Joanna awake. Get up! We have to move! There's enough time, though, to explain the clock theory to them. About Wiris's tick-tocking, and how the movements of the invisible hands trigger a deadly force in each section. I think I've convinced everyone who's conscious, except Joanna, who's naturally opposed to liking anything I suggest, but even she agrees it's better to be safe than sorry. While the others collect our few possessions and get Beatty back in his jumpsuit, I rouse Wiris. She awakes with a panicked tick-tock! Yes, tick-tock, the arena's a clock. It's a clock, Wiris. You were right, I say. You were right. Relief floods her face. I guess because somebody has finally understood what she's known probably from the first tolling of the bells. Midnight. It starts at midnight, I confirm. A memory struggles to surface in my brain. I see a clock. No, it's a watch. Resting in Plutarch Heavensby's palm. It starts at midnight, Plutarch said. And then my mockingjay lit up briefly and vanished. In retrospect, it's like he was giving me a clue about the arena. But why would he? At the time, I was no more a tribute in these games than he was. Maybe he thought it would help me as a mentor. Or maybe... This had been the plan all along. Wiris nods at the blood rain. 1:30, she says. Exactly, 1:30, and at 2, a terrible poisonous fog begins there, I say, pointing at the nearby jungle. So we have to move somewhere safe now. She smiles and stands up obediently. Are you thirsty? I hand her the woven bowl, and she gulps down about a quart. Finnick gives her the last bit of bread, and she gnaws on it. With the inability to communicate overcome, she's functioning again. I check my weapons, tie up the spile and the tube of medicine in the parachute, and fix it to my belt with vine. Beatty's still pretty out of it, but when Peeta tries to lift him, he objects.
"Wire," he says.
She's right here, Peeta tells him.
Wyrus is fine. She's coming too. But still, Beatty struggles.
Wire!
He insists.
Oh, I know what he wants,
says Joanna impatiently. She crosses to the beach and picks up the cylinder we took from his belt when we were bathing him. It's coated in a thick layer of congealed blood.
This worthless thing, it's some kind of wire or something. That's how he got cut, running up to the cornucopia to get this. I don't know what kind of weapon it's supposed to be. I guess you could pull off a piece and use it as a garrote or something. But really, can you imagine Beatty garroting somebody?
He won his games with wire, setting up that electrical trap, says Peeta. It's the best weapon he could have. There's something odd about Joanna not putting this together, something that doesn't quite ring true, suspicious.
Seems like you'd have figured that out, I say, since you nicknamed him Volts and all.
Joanna's eyes narrow at me dangerously.
Yeah, that was really stupid of me, wasn't it? She says. I guess I must have been distracted by keeping your little friends alive. While you were, what again? Getting Mags killed off?
My fingers tighten on the knife handle at my belt.
Go ahead, try it. I don't care if you're knocked up. I'll rip your throat out, says Joanna.
I know I can't kill her right now, but it's just a matter of time with Joanna and me before one of us offs the other.
Maybe we all better be careful where we step, says Finnick, shooting me a look.
He takes the coil and sets it on Beatty's chest.
There's your wire, Volts. Watch where you plug it.
Peeta picks up the now unresisting Beatty.
Where to? I'd like to go to the cornucopia and watch, just to make sure we're right about the clock, says Finnick.
It seems as good a plan as any. Besides, I wouldn't mind the chance of going over the weapons again. And there are six of us now. Even if you count Beatty and Wyrus out, we've got four good fighters. It's so different from where I was last year at this point, doing everything on my own. Yes, it's great to have allies, as long as you can ignore the thought that you'll have to kill them. Beatty and Wyrus will probably find some way to die on their own. If we have to run from something, how far would they get? Joanna, frankly, I could easily kill if it came down to protecting Peeta. Or maybe even just to shut her up. What I really need is for someone to take out Finnick for me, since I don't think I can do it personally. Not after all he's done for Peeta. I think about maneuvering him into some kind of encounter with the careers. It's cold, I know, but what are my options? Now that we know about the clock, he probably won't die in the jungle, so someone's going to have to kill him in battle. Because this is so repellent to think about, my mind frantically tries to change topics, but the only thing that distracts me from my current situation is fantasizing about killing President Snow. Not very pretty daydreams for a 17-year-old girl, I guess, but very satisfying. We walk down the nearest sand strip, approaching the cornucopia with care, just in case the careers are concealed there. I doubt they are, because we've been on the beach for hours and there's been no sign of life. The area's abandoned, as I expected. Only the big golden horn and the picked-over pile of weapons remain. When Peeta lays Beatty in the bit of shade the cornucopia provides, he calls out to Wyrus. She crouches beside him, and he puts the coil of wire in her hands.
"Clean it, will you?" he asks.
Wyrus nods and scampers over to the water's edge, where she dunks the coil in the water. She starts quietly singing some funny little song about a mouse running up a clock. It must be for children, but it seems to make her happy.
"Oh, not that song again," says Joanna, rolling her eyes. "That went on for hours before she started tick-tocking."
Suddenly, Wyrus stands up very straight and points to the jungle.
"Two," she says.
I follow her finger to where the wall of fog has just begun to seep out onto the beach.
Yes, look, Wyrus is right. It's 2 o'clock and the fog has started.
Like clockwork, says Peeta. You were very smart to figure that out, Wyrus.
Wyrus smiles and goes back to singing and dunking her coil.
Oh, she's more than smart, says Beatty. She's intuitive.
We all turn to look at Beatty, who seems to be coming back to life.
She can sense things before anyone else, like a canary in one of your coal mines.
What's that? Finnick asks me.
It's a bird that we take down into the mines to warn us if there's bad air, I say.
What's it do, die? Asks Joanna.
It stops singing first. That's when you should get out. But if the air's too bad, it dies, yes. And so do you. I don't want to talk about dying songbirds. They bring up thoughts of my father's death, and Rue's death, and Maisie Donner's death, and my mother inheriting her songbird. Oh, great. And now I'm thinking of Gale, deep down in that horrible mine, with President Snow's threat hanging over his head. So easy to make it look like an accident down there, a silent canary, a spark, and nothing more. I go back to imagining killing the president. Despite her annoyance at Wyrus, Joanna's as happy as I've seen her in the arena. While I'm adding to my stock of arrows, she pokes around until she comes up with a pair of lethal-looking axes. Seems an odd choice, until I see her throw one with such force it sticks in the sun-softened gold of the cornucopia. Of course! Joanna Mason, District 7, Lumber. I bet she's been tossing around axes since she could toddle. It's like Finnick with his trident, or Beatty with his wire, Rue with her knowledge of plants. I realize it's just another disadvantage the District 12 tributes have faced over the years. We don't go down in the mines until we're 18. It looks like most of the other tributes learned something about their trades early on. There are things you do in a mine that could come in handy in the games. Wielding a pick, blowing things up, give you an edge, the way my hunting did. But we learn them too late. While I've been messing with the weapons, Peter's been squatting on the ground, drawing something with the tip of his knife on a large, smooth leaf he brought from the jungle. I look over his shoulder and see he's creating a map of the arena. In the center is the cornucopia on its circle of sand, with the 12 strips branching out from it. It looks like a pie sliced into 12 equal wedges. There's another circle representing the waterline, and a slightly larger one indicating the edge of the jungle. Look how the cornucopia's positioned, he says to me. I examine the cornucopia and see what he means. The tail points towards 12 o'clock, I say.
Right. So this is the top of our clock, he says,
and quickly scratches the numbers 1 through 12 around the clock face. 12 to 1 is the lightning zone. He writes lightning in tiny print in the corresponding wedge, then works clockwise, adding blood, fog, and monkeys in the following sections. And 10 to 11 is the wave, I say. He adds it. Finnick and Joanna join us at this point, armed to the teeth with tridents, axes, and knives. Did you notice anything unusual in the others? I ask Joanna and Beatty, since they might have seen something we didn't. But all they've seen is a lot of blood. I guess they could hold anything. I'm going to mark the ones where we know the game maker's weapon follows us out past the jungle, so we'll stay clear of those, says Peeta, drawing diagonal lines on the fog and wave beaches. Then he sits back.
Well, it's a lot more than we knew this morning, anyway.
We all nod in agreement, and that's when I notice it. The silence. Our canary has stopped singing.
I don't wait. I load an arrow as I twist and get a glimpse of a dripping wet gloss letting Wyrus slide to the ground, her throat slit open in a bright red smile. The point of my arrow disappears into his right temple, and in the instant it takes to reload, Joanna has buried an axe blade in Kashmir's chest. Finnick knocks away a spear Brutus throws at Peeta and takes Inabaria's knife in his thigh. If there wasn't a cornucopia to duck behind, they'd be dead, both of the tributes from District 2. I spring forward in pursuit. Boom, boom, boom. The cannon confirms there's no way to help Wyrus. No need to finish off Gloss or Kashmir. My allies and I are rounding the horn, starting to give chase to Brutus and Inabaria, who are sprinting down a sand strip toward the jungle. Suddenly, the ground jerks beneath my feet, and I'm flung on my side in the sand. The circle of land that holds the cornucopia starts spinning fast, really fast, and I can see the jungle going by in a blur. I feel the centrifugal force pulling me toward the water and dig my hands and feet into the sand, trying to get some purchase on the unstable ground. Between the flying sand and the dizziness, I have to squeeze my eyes shut. There is literally nothing I can do but hold on until, with no deceleration, we slam to a stop. Coughing and queasy, I sit up slowly to find my companions in the same condition. Finnick, Joanna, and Peeta have hung on. The three dead bodies have been tossed out into the seawater. The whole thing, from missing Wyrus's song to now, can't have taken more than a minute or two. We sit there, panting, scraping the sand out of our mouths. "Where's Volts?" says Joanna. "We're on our feet. One wobbly circle of the cornucopia confirms he's gone. Finnick spots him about 20 yards out in the water, barely keeping afloat, and swims out to haul him in. That's when I remember the wire and how important it was to him. I look frantically around. Where is it? Where is it? And then I see it, still clutched in Wyrus's hand, far out in the water. My stomach contracts at the thought of what I must do next. "Cover me," I say to the others. I toss aside my weapons and race down the strip closest to her body. Without slowing down, I dive into the water and start for her. Out of the corner of my eye, I can see the hovercraft appearing over us, the claw starting to descend to take her away. But I don't stop. I just keep swimming as hard as I can and end up slamming into her body. I come up gasping, trying to avoid swallowing the blood-stained water that spreads out from the open wound in her neck. She's floating on her back, borne up by her belt and death, staring into that relentless sun. As I tread water, I have to wrench the coil of wire from her fingers because her final grip on it is so tight. There's nothing I can do then but close her eyelids, whisper goodbye, and swim away. By the time I swing the coil up onto the sand and pull myself from the water, her body's gone. But I can still taste her blood mingled with the sea salt. I walk back to the cornucopia. Finnick's gotten Beatty back alive, although a little waterlogged, sitting up and snorting out water. He had the good sense to hang on to his glasses, so at least he can see. I place the reel of wire on his lap. It's sparkling clean, no blood left at all. He unravels a piece of the wire and runs it through his fingers. For the first time, I see it, and it's unlike any wire I know. A pale golden color, and as fine as a piece of hair. I wonder how long it is. There must be miles of the stuff to fill the large spool. But I don't ask, because I know he's thinking of Wyrus. I look at the others' sober faces. Now Finnick, Joanna, and Beatty have all lost their district partners. I cross to Peeta and wrap my arms around him, and for a while we all stay silent. "Let's get off this stinking island," Joanna says finally. There's only the matter of our weapons now, which we've largely retained. Fortunately, the vines here are strong, and the spile and tube of medicine wrapped in the parachute are still secured to my belt. Finnick strips off his undershirt and ties it around the wound Inabaria's knife made in his thigh. It's not deep. Beatty thinks he can walk now, if we go slowly, so I help him up. We decide to head to the beach at 12 o'clock. That should provide hours of calm and keep us clear of any poisonous residue. And then Peter, Joanna, and Finnick head off in 3 different directions.
12 o'clock, right? Says Peter. The tail points at 12.
Before they spun us, says Finnick. I was judging by the sun.
The sun only tells you it's going on 4, Finnick, I say.
I think Katniss's point is, knowing the time doesn't mean you necessarily know where 4 is on the clock. You might have a general idea of the direction, unless you consider that they may have shifted the outer ring of jungle as well, says Beatty.
No, Katniss's point was a lot more basic than that. Beatty's articulated a theory far beyond my comment on the sun. But I just nod my head like I've been on the same page all along.
Yes, so any one of these paths could lead to 12 o'clock, I say.
We circle around the cornucopia, scrutinizing the jungle. It has a baffling uniformity. I remember the tall tree that took the first lightning strike at 12 o'clock. But every sector has a similar tree. Joanna thinks to follow Inobaria's and Brutus's tracks, but they have been blown or washed away. There's no way to tell where anything is.
I should have never mentioned the clock, I say bitterly. Now they've taken that advantage away as well.
Only temporarily, says Beatty. At 10, we'll see the wave again and be back on track.
Yes, they can't redesign the whole arena, says Peter.
It doesn't matter, says Joanna impatiently. You had to tell us, or we never would have moved our camp in the first place, brainless.
Ironically, her logical, if demeaning, reply is the only one that comforts me. Yes, I had to tell them to get them to move.
Come on, I need water. Anyone have a good gut feeling?
We randomly choose a path and take it, having no idea what number we're headed for. When we reach the jungle, we peer into it, trying to decipher what may be waiting inside.
Well, it must be monkey hour.
And I don't see any of them in there, says Peter.
I'm going to try to tap a tree.
No, it's my turn, says Finnick. I'll at least watch your back, Peter says.
Katniss can do that, says Joanna. We need you to make another map, the other washed away.
She yanks a large leaf off a tree and hands it to him. For a moment, I'm suspicious they're trying to divide and kill us, but it doesn't make sense. I'll have the advantage on Finnick if he's dealing with the tree, and Peter's much bigger than Joanna. So I follow Finnick about 15 yards into the jungle, where he finds a good tree and starts stabbing to make a hole with his knife. As I stand there, weapons ready, I can't lose the uneasy feeling that something is going on and that it has to do with Peter. I retrace our steps, starting from the moment the gong rang out, searching for the source of my discomfort. Finnick towing Peter in off his metal plate, Finnick reviving Peter after the force field stopped his heart, Mags running into the fog so that Finnick could carry Peter, the Morphling hurling herself in front of him to block the monkey's attack. The fight with the careers was so quick, but didn't Finnick block Brutus's spear from hitting Peter, even though it meant taking Inabaria's knife in his leg? And even now, Joanna has him drawing a map on a leaf rather than risking the jungle. There is no question about it. For reasons completely unfathomable to me, some of the other victors are trying to keep him alive, even if it means sacrificing themselves. I'm dumbfounded. For one thing, that's my job. For another, it doesn't make sense. Only one of us can get out. So why have they chosen Peter to protect
What has Haymitch possibly said to them? What has he bargained with to make them put Peeta's life above their own?